Electricity, a big idea that's inspired countless new ones. From powering the light bulb to virtually powering our entire lives. 30 years ago, State Street launched the Spider S&P 500 ETF, SPY. A big idea that inspired the world to invest differently. And still does. What can you do with SPY?
Before investing, consider the fund's investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses. Visit SSGA.com for a prospectus containing this and other information. Read it carefully before investing. SPY is subject to risks similar to those of stocks. All ETFs are subject to risk, including possible loss of principal. Alps Distributors, Inc. Distributor.
I'm Eamon Javers in tonight for Brian Sullivan. Right now on Last Call, a Boeing whistleblower speaks out exclusively ahead of tomorrow's hearing. We have the disturbing new allegations. Cyber Skids, new troubles with the Cybertruck causing Tesla shares to do something they haven't done in over a year. An election twist fit for Hollywood. The producer's son of Republican mega donor Larry Ellison just stunned the political world. We'll have the details. And fueling the fentanyl crisis, an explosive new report out of Congress points blame at China. A committee member will join us. And something happened to shares of DJT today, and it could spell even more trouble for shareholders, plus longevity and your credit score. We've got eye-opening new data that you have to see. All that and more over the next hour. Last Call is up right now. And good evening here, good afternoon out west. We'll have all of that and more coming up in our hour. But first up on Last Call, it's a tax day of reckoning. President Biden speaking in Scranton, Pennsylvania this afternoon, calling for a tax hike on billionaires in America to help curb the federal deficit.
My plan calls for a minimum federal income tax of 25%, just 25% on billionaires. Well below the top rate, but fair, and they can afford it. You know how much money that would raise? That would raise $500 billion over the next 10 years. During the whole time, I've been able to cut the federal deficit at the same exact time by over $1 trillion. I want to cut the federal deficit even more by making big corporations and the very wealthy begin to finally pay their fair share.
Now, Biden's comments come as the International Monetary Fund releasing its annual World Economic Outlook today, and it had a stark message about the United States and its national debt and spending, writing in part, quote, "The exceptional recent performance of the United States is certainly impressive and a major driver of global growth, but it reflects strong demand factors as well, including a fiscal stance that is out of line with long-term fiscal sustainability." Now, the 10-year Treasury yield hitting its highest level since last year as the debt and spending crisis rages on. And while both sides of the political aisle point fingers, the national debt has been steadily on the rise under both the Trump and Biden administrations. So will a tax hike on the billionaire class help curb the federal deficit? And could this proposal curb President Biden's re-election chances? Let's bring out our A-list panel, Actum Consulting co-chair, former OMB director, and former White House chief of staff Mick Mulvaney, and former North Dakota senator, University of Chicago Institute of Politics director, and CNBC contributor Heidi Heitkamp. Senator, let me start with you. You heard what the president had to say today about billionaires being able to afford it. Do you think this is good politics, and do you think this is good economics?
I think it's really good politics. I mean, this is a political document. When you look at what can actually be accomplished, Mick and I were there during the tax debate in 2017. You know, it's not practical. And a lot of what the president's saying, he knows he can't get. And the irony of taking a look at the 17 tax bill, which will in fact expire in the next term of the next president, when you look at what's going to expire, probably the most progressive piece of that is the limitation on the state and local tax deduction, which is heavily favored by blue states. So, you know, this is a political statement. I think we have a huge debt and deficit problem. It, clearly, the tax code has added to wealth and income disparity, but you shouldn't take this too seriously as policy initiatives that are going to pass.
Mick, I'm assuming you don't take it seriously at all. You don't think it's good politics necessarily or a good idea economically, right?
Well, I think Heidi's right in that this was a political speech. This is designed to get the Democrat base fired up. And I get that. This is going to be a base turnout election, I think, just because there's so few undecided voters. You've got two of the most well-known politicians of the last 50 years going against each other. So the real key is, can you get your folks to show up? And soaking the rich is a message that tends to get at the base Democrat voters. And I get all of that. I just wonder, put the economics aside, because I don't take that seriously, the politics of it. I just wonder how much him talking about the economy is going to help him. I mean, we just heard Jay Powell come out today and said that maybe rates aren't going to get cut at all. That's not a good message for the Biden team on the economy. He needs the economy to get better right now. And here he is out talking about it. He's not using the word Bidenomics anymore. And I get that. But the more he talks about the economy, I'm just not sure that's the A message right now for the Biden team.
So just so everybody has the numbers, we've got the deficit figures under Trump and under Biden here. Take a look as we continue to debate this, because that gives you sort of just the baseline reality of where the federal deficit has been and is trending right now. And look, ultimately, you know, we are three people who have spent a lot of time in Washington, a little bit grizzled, maybe a little bit cynical. At least I'm grizzled. You guys look great. But we can say this is just politics. But there's a problem here with the federal deficit, which is that interest payments on the debt crowd out all the other spending that you might want to make. Ultimately, you want to spend money on defense, aid to Ukraine, domestic policies. All of that stuff is stuff that you can't afford if you're spending more and more on interest on the debt. So, Mick, let me stick with you for a second and just ask you what you think ultimately is going to happen here, because I think you said to me at one point years ago that it was frustrating that nobody in Washington seriously wanted to actually cut the debt. Even those people who say they do, there's just not political will to do it.
Oh, no, you don't get $34 trillion in debt because of one party. Both parties have been doing it now to us since the early 1980s. But when you say there's a crowding out, that's you being the rational CNBC reporter, not someone who lives and works in Washington, D.C. There is no such thing as crowding out. All they're going to do is continue to spend the more money. It's how you get the debt in the first place. If the interest payments go to $1 trillion, we will borrow that money. There is no appetite, Eamon, zero right now, to lower spending on Washington, D.C. And I'm talking, you know, Republicans always want to talk about entitlement spending, and that's great. But they don't even have an appetite to lower the discretionary side of the budget either. If you put a gun to Washington's head tomorrow and said you have to balance the budget, they could not do it. So this is going to go on until the system breaks.
So, Senator, that's the question, the system breaking, right? I mean, the weird thing about this debate is nobody knows where the red line is. Ultimately, it's up to bond buyers out there who are buying U.S. treasuries. And we're continuing to borrow by selling treasuries to bond buyers. That's a vast international market, very liquid. And at some point, psychologically, those bond buyers might say, well, we don't think the U.S. is good for it anymore. And that's when the system breaks down. And we have no idea where that is. We don't know how many years away, how many dollars away that is from where we are right now.
We used to say when the debt reaches the annual GDP, that's a trigger point. We have to look at it. But I want to push back a little bit on what Mick said about the economy. What you heard the International Monetary Fund say, yeah, your economy's good. You're juicing it quite a bit, and that's a problem, and you're going to have problems with debt and deficit. And the reality is, until the voters make debt and deficit an issue, you're not going to solve it. And you can cut discretionary domestic spending 75% and not actually achieve a budget that's in balance. Well, and so we all know, I mean, those of us in Washington, we know the problems. There just is not the political will to fix it, but there has to be at some point.
We had Christine Lagarde on CNBC earlier today. If voters are the same at all as consumers, and we think, you know, broadly they might be, American consumers are consuming, right? I mean, she said there's a striking difference between what they're doing in Europe, where they're saving, and what American consumers are doing, which is spending. Maybe the consumers and voters are electing politicians who do in the government what they're doing in their own pocketbooks. Mick?
Yeah, I sat in the White House one time with a very high-ranking Republican who leaned across the Resolute Desk of the president with my budget in his hand and said, "Mr. President, I really like Mr. Mulvaney. He's a smart young man. He's good on numbers. I get this. But let's make one thing perfectly clear. He's not elected, and you are. No one has ever lost his or her job in this town for spending too much money."
Right.
That is how you get $34 trillion in debt. And Heidi's right. Until the voters start penalizing people for spending too much and running up too much debt, It is not going to change.
It has to end somewhere. Let's hope it doesn't end ugly. We were just looking at a poetic shot, live shot of the White House there with the sun setting over it. I hope that's not too ominous for tonight. But Mick, Senator, thank you both for being here. Let's take a look at what happened to your money today. Meanwhile, the Dow closed up a modest 63 points. S&P 500 down 0.2%. And the NASDAQ down about 0.1%. On to our studs and duds for the day. The biggest winner of the day, Supermicrocomputer, up 10.6%. After Loop slapped a $1,500 price target on the stock. That's the highest on the street. Biggest loser today, Live Nation, down 7.6. The DOJ reportedly readying an antitrust suit against the ticketing giant. Some people might cheer for that, not so much the stockholders. And let's get a look at futures, all in the green tonight as we go into tomorrow's trading. And on deck here, a Boeing whistleblower's exclusive must-see comments ahead of a high-stakes hearing tomorrow, plus how Tesla is taking some serious air out of Cybertruck buyers. Stay with us.
People today can spend half their lives over 50. So it's good to be financially ready for what's important to you as you get older, like a family vacation. Or starting your dream business.
Welcome to Connie's Coffee. How may I help you?
AARP's trusted financial tools can help you plan for whatever your future holds. That's why the younger you are, the more you need AARP. Start planning today at aarp.org/moneytools.
This podcast is supported by FedEx. Dear small and medium businesses, no one wants happy customers more than you do. So you need a business partner just like you. Like FedEx, who understands your passion for serving your customers because they have the same commitment towards you. That's why FedEx offers you picture proof of delivery, packageless and paperless returns, as well as weekend home delivery to 98% of the U.S. on Saturday and 50% on Sunday. See the FedEx service guide for delivery information. What's more, FedEx Ground is faster to more locations than UPS Ground. Trust FedEx for timely deliveries. See what FedEx can do for your business. Absolutely, positively FedEx.
Welcome back. Let's get to tomorrow's news tonight. The stories that you and Wall Street will be talking about tomorrow. First up, Red Lobster considering filing for Chapter 11 bankruptcy. That's according to Bloomberg. The seafood chain is weighing other options as well as restructuring, and the company is looking to renegotiate leases and lose other long-term contracts. Next up, the Caitlin Clark effect hitting WNBA draft ratings. A record 2.45 million viewers tuned into ESPN last night to see Clark get drafted by the Indiana Fever. The previous record was set 20 years ago. Clark, by the way, will make a rather modest amount from her four-year rookie contract. It's worth just $328,000 for comparison. Last year's number one NBA draft pick, Victor Wembanyama, scored a $55 million four-year contract. And finally tonight, United posting earnings after the bell. The company seeing a narrower than expected loss and strong travel demand. The stock is soaring after hours. Soaring. See what we did there? Let's bring in CNBC's Phil LeBeau to save us from the puns. Hey, Phil, what's been the impact here on United's earnings?
Eamon, these were far better earnings than anybody was expected. Yes, it was a loss for the quarter, but a far lower loss than what was expected. In fact, they took a $200 million impact. That was the impact hit that they took from the 737 MAX 9 grounding back in January. You strip that out. If they didn't have that, they would have had a profitable quarter. And nobody was expecting that combination of better than expected revenue per seat mile, in addition to lower than expected cost per seat mile. Put those two together and you do better than Wall Street was expecting. That impact of the MAX 9 grounding, as I mentioned, about $200 million. And that is part of what's happened from the first quarter, which will have ripple effects throughout the year. Why will it have ripple effects? Well, they've already said that, and they told us this back in January, that they were going to be converting some MAX 10s to MAX 9 orders. Now you've got them leasing 35 Airbus A321neos. They're announcing that today. They were looking for those since they're not going to have the MAX 10s. They're going to be cutting their plan in terms of how many narrow-body planes to take delivery of this year. Look at this. They were expecting 101 in January. Now they're saying this year they expect to take delivery of 61 of those. Lots to discuss with United CEO Scott Kirby tomorrow morning on Squawk Box. It is a CNBC exclusive. You do not want to miss what he has to say, not only about this, not only about their fleet plans, especially bringing in more Airbus, but remember, United is the largest operator of Dreamliners in the world. So the comments that will be heard tomorrow on Capitol Hill regarding the whistleblower, you can bet that United will be watching those comments closely.
Yeah, Phil, we'll be watching for that interview. But I wonder, on the earnings call here, what are you expecting in terms of comments about safety? Obviously, these headlines have just been brutal for United. So what do you expect to hear?
Two things. One, they've got their own maintenance issues that are under investigation from the FAA. And I know Scott Kirby well, and I know that for him and his team, the first goal is to make sure everybody at United understands that they have to do a better job when it comes to maintenance. And I expect to hear that from him during our interview, also on the conference call with analysts. In terms of safety concerns with the Dreamliner or with Boeing airplanes, I think Scott Kirby will say what you hear from a lot of people in the industry, which is we work closely with Boeing, we work closely with the FAA and other regulators. Number one job is safety. They have to make sure that the customer is convinced the planes are safe, because they have to be convinced the planes are safe. That has become tantamount, not just at United, but with all airlines.
Yeah, absolutely. So important. I'm flying tomorrow, Phil. I want to know that the planes are safe, too. Thanks for that. And look, as we mentioned ahead of the Senate hearings on Boeing tomorrow, NBC News' Tom Costello speaking exclusively with the Boeing engineer sounding the alarm on the 787 Dreamliner aircraft. Tom Costello joins me now.
Yeah, hey, Eamon, so let me bring up a poor man's prop. Assume that this is the fuselage of a plane, okay? It usually comes in pieces, so you mate the two pieces of the fuselage together. This 15-year veteran Boeing engineer is saying that the gaps between some of the fuselages are too wide. It's paper thin, but it's too wide. And he says that could lead to essentially a fatigue within the composite material of that 787 Dreamliner. And with fatigue, you can have cracking, and that could be catastrophic. So this engineer will tell Congress tomorrow this is a dangerous, dangerous situation. Here's what he told us in an interview today.
If your gaps are larger, then you are... Your airplane is susceptible to fatigue, premature fatigue failure.
What would happen if these pieces were subject to fatigue?
Well, what would happen is if you're flying, it can break down in the midair and come down.
The plane could break apart in midair, you think?
Absolutely.
Boeing, however, says that that is absolutely ridiculous. It says it has been testing the 787 Dreamliner. It's been under an FAA-authorized program to ensure that those small gaps, again, the size of a paper, that they are, in fact, safe and that the plane is made up properly. Here's what Boeing said to us in a statement today. It says the following: the issues raised have been subjected and subject to rigorous engineering examination under FAA oversight. This analysis has validated that these issues do not present any safety concerns, and the aircraft will maintain its service life over several decades. We continue to monitor these issues under established regulatory protocols. That's the bottom line. There are 1,100 of these 787s flown worldwide. There hasn't been a single case, according to Boeing, under all of their reviews, not a single case of fatigue showing up, and certainly not cracking. And in fact, Boeing insists all the evidence would tell you that composite-made planes are far, far more robust than the typical plane made of aluminum. So Boeing pushing back very hard ahead of this FAA hearing tomorrow that looks at all the problems lately affiliated with Boeing on the 737 MAX, on the MAX 9, the door plug, the quality control breakdowns in its plants, and now a whistleblower engineer coming forward. Eamon, back to you.
That is scary stuff. Tom, thanks. Coming up here, a fundraising shock in the 2024 presidential race, courtesy of Larry Ellison's son. Plus, a bombshell report just out from Congress on China and its role in the fentanyl crisis. One of the lawmakers behind that report is going to be here with us. Stay with us.
This podcast is supported by FedEx. Dear small and medium businesses, no one wants happy customers more than you do.
That's why FedEx offers you picture proof of delivery, package-less and paperless returns, as well as weekend home delivery to 98% of the U.S. on Saturday and 50% on Sunday. See the FedEx service guide for delivery information. FedEx Ground service is also faster to more locations than UPS Ground. See what FedEx can do for your business. Absolutely, positively, FedEx.
Welcome back. The Biden campaign got a near $1 million donation from Skydance Media CEO David Ellison. He's the son of Republican mega donor and Oracle chairman Larry Ellison. You may have heard of him. With me tonight for more on all this is CNBC.com political finance reporter Brian Schwartz. Brian, I am glad that you're on this beat. You're so good at digging this stuff up. And this story has sort of like Shakespearean, Oedipal overtones. I mean, it's father, it's son, it's money into the political system. Tell me what's going on.
Well, it's fascinating, Eamon, because you know it's over $900,000 that came from David Ellison, the son, as you mentioned, of Larry Ellison, the Republican mega donor, chairman of Oracle. And what's interesting about this is, beyond the fact that he's the son of a major Republican donor, is that this involved, you know, in, from our reporting, a kind of a lobbying campaign to get David to come on board and give as much as he did back in February. It involved players like Hollywood mogul Jeffrey Katzenberg and some other big Republican donors that we mentioned in our story on CNBC.com. So it really was to us like a fascinating push to get David Ellison to come on board, to give as much as he did back in February. And it's a big amount, and it helped the committee that he gave to raise over $121 million in the first quarter of this year.
Yeah, I wonder what's going on here between father and son. Is this just about the fact that the son is in Hollywood now and you know he's got to breathe the Hollywood air with all the rest of those guys, and that tends to be Biden country? Or is this about a split with his dad, just doesn't agree with the way he was raised and doesn't look at things the same way? What insights do you have into the personalities here?
Well, it feels like it's the latter, right? I don't think there's any tension between the father and son because, as we both know, there's a big media deal going on right now featuring David Ellison's company, Paramount, and National Amusements. And
yes,
what I've read is that Larry Ellison, his father, could be involved with helping finance that larger deal. So, you know, I don't think there's necessarily a major like negative split between the two, but I do think it speaks to the policy differences between both the father and son. And listen, David Ellison's team declined to comment to us when we brought that question directly to them, because we don't know for sure. But it is a fascinating timing between what we're seeing here with this media deal going on, the discussions around this media deal, and where is Larry Ellison right now? He has not registered a donation to anyone so far this election cycle.
Yeah, he's going to be worth watching for the rest of the year to see whether he puts his money down. Or maybe father and son just kind of come to a truce. They say, hey, look, Dad, you know, you don't give any money. I don't give any money. We'll cancel each other out and the family will benefit and we can pocket all the cash that we otherwise would have spent canceling each other's donations out. Brian, that's an unanswerable, but thank you for being here with that. Really appreciate it. Meantime, a new report from the House Select Committee on the Chinese Communist Party says China is funding the U.S. fentanyl crisis. According to the report, China is using tax rebates to subsidize the manufacturing and export of fentanyl materials, awarding grants to companies openly trafficking in the narcotic, economically benefiting from the ongoing epidemic, and more. Those are only three of the investigation's findings. So with us tonight for more on this is U.S. Congressman and House Select Committee on the Chinese Communist Party ranking member Raja Krishnamoorthy. Congressman, thank you for joining Last Call tonight. Tell me what you found, first of all, in this report.
Well, I think a couple of statistics just jump out at you. One is that 97% of all illicit fentanyl that arrives in the U.S. comes from China. That's one. The second is there were zero reported deaths related to fentanyl in China, but there were more than 110,000 fentanyl-related deaths in the U.S. And that basically points to two things. One, the Chinese are very, very good at enforcing their own internal drug laws, prosecuting traffickers, and in a lot of cases, executing them and controlling the drug problem internally. But two, when it comes to their companies and entities and individuals exporting illicit fentanyl to the U.S., they, to charitably put it, turn a blind eye and remain unconcerned.
Yeah, that blind eye question, I think, is the important one. I had a chance to review this report last night before it became public this morning. And my question is really around this question of intent by the Chinese government. Is this sort of one of these things where, you know, they kind of subsidize some of these companies that are producing these fentanyl precursors because they subsidize every company in China? And so they're just kind of scooping up these companies in that basket? Or is this an intentional act by the Chinese government to push these companies and to push this stuff into the United States? What do you think?
I don't know. I don't have an answer as to what's inside Xi Jinping's head or the Standing Politburo. However, here's the evidence that we do know. One is that they certainly know of the companies who receive these VAT tax rebates, these subsidies for the export of various products, including fentanyl, including illicit fentanyl. Secondly, a lot of these companies actually are controlled by the Chinese Communist Party. In other words, they have stakes, they're state-owned entities in some cases, or they have what are called golden shares or board seats on those companies' boards. And then the third thing, which is very disturbing, is that some of these entities receive awards, recognition, other forms of grants from the state for their activities, including their illicit activities, apparently.
Yeah, and I guess it's not necessarily an either or, right? It's not that this is the Chinese government being oblivious to it or that it's a strategic, intentional thing. I mean, there could be some corruption at stake here where you just have officials in the middle of the hierarchy turning a blind eye, maybe taking some money and allowing this activity to go on, but it's not sort of a deliberate Chinese government action. And so if that's the case, then the big question is, what do you do about it as the U.S. government? I mean, you're sitting there on Capitol Hill. You have all sorts of legislative opportunities. The executive branch has its own set of skills that it can use. What do you do here as the U.S. government now that you know what we know from your report today?
I think you do at least a couple things. One, which is a no-brainer, is that we actually don't have a sanctions authority that the White House or the executive branch can use to sanction those companies that actually do a lot of legitimate business, but then operate this side hustle of engaging in the export of illegal fentanyl precursors. Believe it or not, there are a lot of those types of companies in China, and we should absolutely have sanctions authority with regard to them. The second is, unfortunately, even today, you can go onto e-commerce sites in China and order fentanyl or other powerful synthetic opioids and have it delivered to you by U.S. mail and other types of delivery services, believe it or not. And so it's astonishing, but it's happening every day. And unfortunately, one of the things that we need to do is we need to close certain loopholes, or we need to at least radically change them such that, for instance, packages less than $800 in value receive a lot more scrutiny than they do today by the Customs and Border Patrol. Yeah. Because today there's something called the de minimis exception where they don't receive that type of scrutiny.
Congressman, fascinating report. Thank you for being on Last Call tonight to bring us the details. Really appreciate your insights there. Coming up here, a new pothole for Tesla shares, why Cybertruck buyers may be sitting idle. See what we did there? Sitting idle? That's coming up next. Time to get to our Last Call watch list. Another major down day for Trump media as retail excitement around ticker DJT begins to fade. If you back it up to the day Trump media started trading on March 26th, the stock has tumbled a long way. The former president's company has lost more than half its value since then. But what might be even more interesting is the trading volume on the stock. On that first day of trading, when the stock was soaring, 55 million shares changed hands. But since then, trading activity has really dived. DJT volume hasn't exceeded 10 million shares in 2 weeks, with just about 7 million shares traded today. So volume down, price down. This looks like a tough situation for the current shareholders in DJT. Meantime, Tesla's Cybertruck is hitting roadblocks. According to the Wall Street Journal, the EV maker is delaying deliveries for its newest vehicle and not telling buyers why. It's unclear how many buyers have been affected by the delays, but it just adds to the growing list of concern for Tesla investors. Tesla shares closing down nearly 3% today. The stock just a hair above a $500 billion market cap amid growing struggles across the entire EV landscape. Both Lucid and Rivian hitting all-time lows this week. Tough out there for everybody in this space. With me tonight for more on Tesla's latest stumble is Gerber Kawasaki, President and CEO Ross Gerber. Ross, thank you for joining Last Call. Your firm has been divesting out of Tesla recently. First of all, tell me how much Tesla you own right now.
Currently, we own a little over 300,000 shares when we update our 13F, and we were as high as 500,000 shares at the top in the middle of last year of our position. So we've pared our position fairly substantially.
So you've got tens of millions of dollars at stake. You're not cheering this stock on the way down. Obviously, you know, you don't want to lose that money, but you have been a Tesla skeptic. Is there anything out there that would make you start to buy again and start to believe the narrative again?
Yeah, first of all, I'm not a Tesla skeptic. I'm a huge fan of the company, and I love the products. I think they're the best cars on the road. I'm a skeptic of Elon Musk's management style at this point.
Fair point.
So, you know, what got Tesla to be as successful as it is was a very focused CEO who worked very hard for Tesla. But ever since he's left Tesla and bought Twitter, basically nobody's been running the ship, and the ship is clearly having a lot of issues.
So let's ask about some of those issues. I mean, Cybertruck is an interesting one. It's such an unusual looking vehicle. I mean, to put it nicely, I guess, it's a weird car. And a lot of people said, you know, this is either going to be just a huge hit. There's just buyers out there that we haven't identified in the car market before who are going to love this thing and they're going to flock to it and it's going to turn the stock around completely. And other people said, this is like an Edsel, you know, coming down the road at you. How do you think that's shaking out? I mean, obviously, we've seen some mechanical difficulties, too. But is the Cybertruck living up to the hype?
Well, we have one Cybertruck at the office, and I'm actually one of those customers that ordered a Cybertruck. I paid for the Cybertruck and they took my money. And I've tried calling Tesla several times to see what's going on with my truck.
And
I really
can't
get a straight answer from anybody. But the truck we have, we've had a pretty good experience with. You drive a Cybertruck down the street, children are like running after you, staring and pointing. I've never seen the consumer excitement around a product like Cybertruck, which doesn't make it any less polarizing of a vehicle. My wife is not happy on buying a Cybertruck. She's like, what are you going to do with this thing? You know?
Yeah, right.
But it's a niche vehicle. It really is a niche vehicle. It's not a real truck that truck people would buy. And that's what it really is. It's
the question is, are there just other people out there, you know, Terminator fans or whatever, who will buy it and think it's cool? And they want the kids running after them. I mean, that's fun, right? You're in a car. It feels like a big special event. Fascinating to see whether they can capture that energy and translate it into gains for the shareholders. Ross, thanks so much for your insights tonight. Really appreciate it. Coming up here, what do your credit score and your physical health have in common? Turns out a lot. Operation Hope founder John Hope Bryant lays it out in a fascinating new book. We've got the book and we've got John Hope Bryant here coming up next. It turns out your credit score could affect more than your financial health. It could impact your physical health as well. According to our next guest, in communities with a 580 credit score, people tend to live around 61 to 66 years. But in 700 credit score communities, people's lifespans jump dramatically, about 10 years more. It's just one of many points raised in a new book called Financial Literacy for All. And joining me now is the author of that book, philanthropist and social entrepreneur John Hope Bryant. He's also the founder and CEO of Operation Hope and a CNBC contributor. Here's the book right here. And John, this is publication day today. Today's day one.
It is publication
Congratulations.
Day, and it's already number one in economics and a few categories on Amazon, so we're very excited about it globally.
Explain this correlation that you're spotlighting between people's credit scores and their outcomes in life, life expectancy being just one.
Well, first of all, thanks for having me. Love Last Call. Financial literacy is a civil rights issue of this generation. And we have an economy that's the largest economy in the world that's 70% driven by consumer spending. But 70% of Americans are living from paycheck to paycheck. And those who are making $100,000 a year, so that people think this is a poor person's issue, half of those are living from paycheck to paycheck. with too much month at the end of their money.
Yeah.
And if you're making $250,000 a year in Manhattan or wherever, a third of those are living from paycheck to paycheck. You're living in Manhattan making $100,000, feels like $39,000. So the color is green, yep. Not black or white or red or blue. And so it's an economic dissertation that says that financial illiteracy is a national security threat, but it also deals with your financial and health wellness. So if you're living in a 580 credit score neighborhood, our data is backed by Experian data and U.S. Census and a range of other unimpeachable sources. You live at 61 years old on average. And if you're living in a 700 credit score neighborhood, as you mentioned, you're living to 81 or more.
That's an incredible, I mean, it's 20 years.
15 minutes apart, by the way.
Yeah.
Typically all across, and this is all across the country. And so whether you're black and brown urban or you're white, working class and rural, and you live in a 580 credit score neighborhood, here's what you see. You see a check casher next to a payday loan lender, next to a rent-to-own store, next to a title lender, next to a liquor store, next to a pawn shop,
yeah,
and a church down the street trying to make you feel a little bit better once a week. That's your neighborhood therapist, so you don't go crazy. And again, doesn't matter where you're talking about racially, that's target marketing, and folks in those neighborhoods have higher levels of stress, higher levels of obesity, lower lifespans. We've already talked about that. Homeownership rates tend to be below 40% compared to 75% for our mainstream neighborhoods. The high school graduation rate tends to be in the 60s compared to 96% in a 700 credit score neighborhood, which means you go to college, by the way.
Yep. So what do we do about it? I mean, you talk about financial literacy being sort of the secret sauce here to changing some of this. What's the one thing people need to know that they don't know right now in terms of literacy?
Remove the shame.
Shame.
Yeah, because we think that financial literacy is a math equation. It's not. It's emotional. Money's emotional. And it cross connects with your self-esteem or lack thereof, your family structure. If you hang around 9 broke people, you'll be the 10th.
Yeah.
A lot of people got their financial literacy from the kitchen table with their mom and dad. If you're coming from an upwardly mobile family, you listen to dad talk about stocks and bonds and read, you know, the newspaper or whatever financial publication you're reading. You saw mom and dad talk about the mortgage refinance. You went to the country club and caddied for your dad's business partner, and that became where you got your internship from.
Right.
So you got sort of this thing, the memo, without realizing it was a memo.
Right.
But Abraham Lincoln created a bank after the Civil War called the Freedman's Bank. He was killed, unfortunately, a month later, chartered to teach freed slaves about money. So with a lot of populations, they're not dumb and they're not stupid. It's what you don't know that you don't know that's killing you, but you think you know. So we're going into Delta Airlines, and we're doing financial literacy for all 100,000 of their employees. We're going into UPS. We're going into Harley-Davidson and companies that are owned by KKR and Apollo, Venetian Hotel in Las Vegas, and teaching financial literacy. Walmart's doing it for their employees and so on and so forth. And the banks are doing it. We're in the banks.
Yeah.
Getting the bank out of the no business, back in the yes business by getting the credit score up, the debt down, the savings up, creating new emerging market customers. Schools is really where this has to go from a public policy perspective. I had home economics class when I was 9 years old.
I didn't even have that in school.
Where'd you learn it from?
You know, I learned it from my parents, I guess, growing up. I mean, but I'll tell you what, when I went to buy my first car, I still had no idea how that worked. I paid an absolutely outrageous interest rate. My wife still teases me about the interest rate I paid on my first car. Because you just don't know this stuff starting out. What do you think a student needs to know coming out of school that they don't know right now?
You know, you've got to understand that when you're in a relationship with money, either it's using it, you using it, or it's using you.
Yeah, right.
And cash flow is different from profit. And by the way, making money is different from building wealth. So you should want to be focused on building wealth, and you build wealth in your sleep. So home ownership, small business ownership, entrepreneurship, stocks, investments, bonds. You want to have a foothold into that world. You want to make sure if you're in a relationship with somebody, make sure that 2 + 2 = 6, 8, or 10. That's only where the math should not work. If you're in a relationship with somebody, you should be better together because that's your business partner for life.
Yep.
So it's a lot of practical stuff that you get from Operation Open, other sources, and we now do it in this book. Public policy should be looking at doing this in schools. I remember I my banker came in my classroom when I was 9 years old, and I asked him, what'd you do for a living and how'd you get rich legally?
Yeah.
And I was dead serious. He said, I'm a banker and I finance entrepreneurs. So I think that, but also that I became an entrepreneur because of that, but that became my role model. That became my North Star. That got me focused on starting a business, got me focused on savings. And a lot of who I am today started when I was 10 years old, and that banker became my hero.
Yeah.
So people watching this program, who are watching CNBC, are natural role models and mentors and can go into a classroom or a local school, take this book and go teach financial literacy and change someone else's life, and in so doing, change their own. So we need to spark a national movement from the streets to the suites at scale across this country, and this book is the beginning of that movement.
Well, that is a great way to look at it. The book is Financial Literacy for All. John Hope Bryant, there you go. Good luck with the book. Good luck with the message. Really appreciate you being here. Thanks so much
for your time.
My honor. So check out the book. Obviously, that's number one. But right now here, let's get to our Quicker Than the Ticker segment. All the rest of the headlines.
Let's put 60 seconds on the clock. A massive fire in Copenhagen's historic Stock Exchange building, the 400-year-old landmark, partially collapsed. Not known yet what caused the fire. Thankfully, no reported injuries so far. Torrential rain flooding parts of the UAE. The flooding forced Dubai International Airport to close for nearly a half hour. 4 inches of rain fell over 12 hours, which is about what Dubai typically gets in the span of a year. What do ABBA, Blondie, and Biggie have in common? All three are being inducted into the National Recording Registry at the Library of Congress. ABBA's Visitors, Biggie's Ready to Die, and Blondie's Parallel Lines albums are worthy of preservation due to their cultural impact. Maserati unveiling a new electric yacht. It's called the Tridente and has a starting price of a cool $2.6 million. Applebee's is now the official bar and grill of the NFL. The new partnership will, quote, engage football fans across the U.S. Fancy like the NFL. And coming up, what the early flurry of earnings is signaling about the market and what it could mean for your money tomorrow. Stay with us.
And welcome back, everybody. Let's take a quick look at futures here as we head toward 8 p.m. on the East Coast. S&P, Dow Jones, and NASDAQ futures all in the green, not by a lot, but in the green tonight anyway. It's been a rough stretch for your money. The S&P 500 has fallen 4% since its closing high. It's the biggest pullback from a record close since November of last year. All of this comes as we get more earnings results this week. So what should you know ahead of tomorrow's opening bell? Well, let's ask New York Life Investments economist and chief market strategist Lauren Goodwin. Lauren, what are you looking for tomorrow?
What's really important about tomorrow's earnings is that we have some of the first regional banks reporting. And that's important not only for earnings health overall, which in general we expect to be quite strong this quarter, but because of the signal it sends to the real economy. One of the reasons why we believe the Fed is more eager to cut than the data has suggested is because with the yield curve inverted as it is today, it's difficult for the financial sector to make money. They're paying out higher deposit rates than they're able to lend money for. And that's an environment where, in addition to high interest rates, bank lending conditions are quite strict. And in these regional banks in particular, it's been very difficult to remain profitable, to keep lending going. And the reality is that that's a constraint on the real economy. So we'll be looking for clues tomorrow as to whether those financial conditions for small businesses are still constricting.
Where do you think the market is here on this balance between earnings and the Fed? I mean, you know, so much of this attention to the Fed is, you know, kind of suggests that earnings don't really matter as much as the sort of the macro picture, the interest rates, the stuff that the economy is surfing on top of. But do the surfers on top of those boards actually matter? Do you actually look at these earnings and say that's now more important than whatever the Fed does?
The dichotomy here, the reality is that rates are moving higher for the most part for good economic reasons in the U.S. It's because economic data has been strong. It's because consumers are still out there spending. And so, yes, earnings do matter, because when earnings are strong, that's an environment where an equity rally, despite some consolidation when we're concerned about rates, the equity market rally can, in big picture terms, continue. In fact, despite some of the volatility we've seen lately, which we expect may continue, we wouldn't expect the equity market rally to really experience stress until the labor market cracks, which has not been the case, or until earnings growth moves negative. And we sincerely do not expect that for this quarter's earnings.
Very, very short time left, but real quick, do you think we could go an entire year here without a Fed interest rate cut?
I think it's an important risk. Overheating, from my perspective, is the most important risk for investor positioning. I expect we'll start to see some cracks in the labor market before then, but it's certainly possible, and we'll be watching closely.
Thanks so much for your thoughts tonight. Really appreciate those. And before we go here, we're giving a big shout out to our Last Call intern, Bailey Krug. Today is his last day with the show. He's been an excellent addition to the team over this academic year. We wish him good luck as he graduates this spring. Bailey, we will miss you. That's Last Call for tonight.
This podcast is supported by FedEx. Dear small and medium businesses, no one wants happy customers more than you do. So you need a business partner just like you. Like FedEx, who understands your passion for serving your customers because they have the same commitment towards you. That's why FedEx offers you picture proof of delivery, packageless and paperless returns, as well as weekend home delivery to 98% of the U.S. on Saturday and 50% on Sunday. See the FedEx service guide for delivery information. What's more, FedEx Ground is faster to more locations than UPS Ground. Trust FedEx for timely deliveries. See what FedEx can do for your business. Absolutely, positively FedEx.